This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent lawsuit filed by the ACLU for second parent adoption.
You would think North Carolina would be concerned by the best interests of the child. They're not. They don't like gay couples.
We'll hear excerpts from presentations delivered at the Drone Conference in Washington, D.C. The conference was titled Drone Summit, Killing and Spying by Remote Control. July 14th marks the 100th centennial celebration of the birth of Woodrow Wilson Guthrie.
We celebrate Woody Guthrie's birth here in our studio with Eli Smith, an incredible musicologist and banjo player who knows a lot about Woody.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Recently, the American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of North Carolina filed a lawsuit on behalf of six same-sex couples and their children, seeking the right to obtain second-parent adoptions for the children. What is a second-parent adoption? It's when one partner in an unmarried couple adopts the other partner's biological or adoptive child. This can occur in both gay and straight relationships. In December 2010, the North Carolina Supreme Court banned second-parent adoptions for same-sex couples. We get the details from Chris Brook, legal director with the ACLU of North Carolina. Welcome, Chris, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, we understand that the ACLU of North Carolina recently sued to change state adoption laws that you argue unconstitutionally prevent unmarried couples from adopting their partner's children. Tell us briefly about the suit and who's involved in it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was brought by attorneys with the LGBT Project of the National ACLU, also brought by my employer, ACLU of North Carolina. We brought it on behalf of six families here in North Carolina where, you know, one parent has parental rights and a legal relationship with their child or the children that they're raising, and the other parent that's playing sort of an equivalent role in raising that child or children does not have a legal relationship and is treated as a stranger by the law. And the lawsuit seeks to rectify that problem and make uniform adoption laws here in North Carolina such that they focus exclusively on what is in the best interest of the child.
And the current law as it is, did they take that standard best interest of the child into consideration?
So there was actually some litigation back in 2010 where the North Carolina Supreme Court interpreted adoption statutes in our state, and what they found: married couple can adopt, so both individuals in a marriage can adopt. Single individuals in our state can adopt. And then step-parents can adopt either the biological or adoptive child of their spouse. But in that case, what they were being asked to rule on was whether second parent, either unmarried or either gay or straight, in an unmarried couple could adopt to have legal rights and a parental relationship with their child. And the Supreme Court said that that was not allowed, even if it was. So there was no analysis of whether that would be in the best interest of the child. So, you know, we have, and, you know, hope to get the opportunity to sort of speak about some of the plaintiffs involved in the case, but a lot of folks who have had harms already visited on them or could have harms visited on their children due to the fact that the North Carolina Supreme Court has interpreted our adoption statutes here in the state to not allow a second parent adoption, even if, you know, it would be in the best interest of the child. And we're very confident that when you look at all of these six families, anyone who's being reasonable would find that it would be in the best interest of the child or children.
Tell us about those families and what kind of harm is being caused by not allowing both adults to be parents of the children.
Absolutely. And each of the six families that are part of the litigation have a compelling story to tell. I'll highlight a few of them instead of going through all six. Don't want to spend, because I could talk about this forever. Marcy and Chantel, who are the named plaintiffs in this case, actually when Marcy was in labor with their second child, she was transferred to the maternity floor of the hospital after 4 days of labor. And the first nurse that they encountered demanded that Chantel provide a power of attorney or some sort of justification to allow Chantel to remain at Marcy's side during the course of childbirth. And luckily, they did have those papers in order and to remain at the child's side during the course of that. But, you know, the fact that that had to occur and that that wasn't taken for granted and that there was, you know, no legal relationship there recognized could have visited some harm on them if they hadn't been fully prepared. Terry Beck and Leslie Zanaglio are two other of our plaintiffs, and they actually have become certified foster care providers here in the state. And in that role, they went through extensive training for parenting, for education, and you know, doing background checks on whether they would be suitable parents. And after all that, they brought two foster brothers into their home in 2009 that were at that point aged 6 and 7. These children's father had died in 2005, and their biological mother had her rights terminated. Both children have been diagnosed with PTSD. They've been with Terry and Leslie since 2009 and have been thriving in that loving household since then. But only one parent has a legal relationship with the child. And if that parent were to pass away, then the children would be placed in limbo again, and it would be unclear, and the other parent would have to petition to again have a legal relationship and be the adoptive parent of those children, and that doesn't make a great deal of sense of it to us, and that doesn't seem to be in the best interest of those children. One other family that I'll highlight real briefly is Shanna Kerrigan and Megan Parker, sort of a similar situation to Terry and Leslie. They adopted a child from foster care in 2011, again went through that extensive training and background. Their son has cerebral palsy that was exacerbated by the poor care that he received after his birth. And he was actually a ward of the state in Texas before they adopted him. And again, you know, if the adopted parent passed away, he could be placed in legal limbo. And I don't think anyone could say that he was in better shape or was being better cared for, you know, as a ward of the state of Texas, than with two loving parents taking care of them. And I think that, you know, taking steps to make sure that that relationship can be preserved. And if you want to approach it from a pure dollars and cents standpoint, it just makes a lot of sense for these parents to provide care for this child than for him to be a ward of the state, which goes without saying is exceptionally expensive.
Chris, tell us why the lawsuit focuses on same-sex couples versus heterosexual couples, because the law says if you're unmarried, no matter what your sexual preference is, you can't adopt.
Yeah, that is an important thing to recognize right off the bat, is that it does apply equally to unmarried couples, whether they're gay or straight, in North Carolina. The reason that all six of the families involved and all six of the adult plaintiffs, all 12 of the adult plaintiffs involved, are in gay couples is because in North Carolina, at least, there is a remedy available to unmarried straight couples. They could always get married and then rectify the problems where there is not a second parent adoption allowed in this state. So they have some way of moving forward. Their children are fully protected and receive the benefits that flow from a relationship with two parents.
I mean, that is true. They have a remedy, but and a lot of people would say, what a crazy remedy. You're being forced to get married.
Sure.
To do that. But apart from that, what if you're a gay couple and you get married in New York, and then you move to North Carolina? You're married. So in that case, do you think the state would recognize the marriage and therefore allow adoption by both of the gay parents?
They're not going to recognize the marriage outside of the state.
Gotcha.
So if under that circumstance, that hypothetical that you're laying out, if a gay couple were married in North Carolina and then came down to North Carolina.
Well, married in New York, you mean?
From New York to North Carolina, right. That marriage is not going to be recognized
gotcha.
By North Carolina. But, you know, I will say, you know, this litigation is being brought on behalf of same-sex couples here in North Carolina, but ACLU of North Carolina would absolutely support second parent adoption rights for both gay and straight families if the legislature here in North Carolina wanted to consider such a measure.
Chris, how many states have similar laws
that ban second parent adoption altogether?
Right. Roughly.
Yeah, my understanding is that there are only five states that out and out ban it. Hmm. And then there are a number of states that are sort of in some sort of limbo in regards to that. But my recollection is that 20 states and the District of Columbia explicitly permit second parent adoption in some way, shape, or form.
Now, you touched on some of the ways in which children would suffer were something to happen, for example, with the adoptive parent in a relationship. Tell us more specifically. Now, children are excluded from private health insurance benefits, other benefits.
Absolutely. So there are a number of benefits that children in these families that we brought the litigation on behalf of and in similar situations across the state of North Carolina can be really tangibly harmed. And you touched on one of them just a moment ago, which is that children that are denied a legally recognized second parent are left vulnerable because they might not be covered by the second parent's health insurance plan. If there's not a legal relationship between that second parent and the child, they might not be able to get health insurance through that parent. Similarly, you know, workers' compensation benefits. If the second parent is injured or, God forbid, killed at work, the child would be denied those workers' compensation benefits. If the child is sick or injured, hospital personnel may bar the second parent from visiting the child in the hospital or from consenting to needed medical care. And that last circumstance is something that comes up every time that we speak to the six families and these 12 parents, is the real constant fear and worry that one, that the legal parent will, for example, be out of state on business and something will happen to the child when the child is being cared for by the second parent that does not have a legal relationship. And real concerns about whether that second parent would be authorized, would be permitted to authorize medical care, emergency medical care, in the absence of the legal parent. And I think that's a concern that anybody who has kids can really identify with, and the feeling of sort of helplessness in the face of such a grave concern and just wanting to be able to do what's right for your child and not being able to because of this prohibition here in North Carolina.
Chris, on Law and Disorder, we frequently talk about how people's movements really supplement courtroom litigation. On this issue, what is the sense in communities in North Carolina? Is this written about in the newspapers as a bad thing, as a positive?
Well, I think that we were very heartened by, you know, that we filed this litigation last Wednesday, so in the middle of June, and it was on the front page of the Raleigh, Charlotte, Greensboro, Asheville, some of the biggest newspapers here in North Carolina, and we were very encouraged by the media coverage that we received, supportive, and I think that's because these stories are easy for everybody to relate to. We did a lot of polling before filing this litigation, and 80% of individuals support second parent adoption, and those numbers hold up across ages. Those numbers hold up across political identification. You know, they might be a little bit different from young to old, but there is majority support across the board for this because people really do focus on what is in the best interest of the children. I think that should be a case-by-case analysis as opposed to there being sort of a broad rule that basically says second parent adoption is out of bounds altogether.
Chris, can you give us an idea of the scope of how many people this affects?
I can't provide you with sort of a hard figure. It is absolutely something that is not uncommon. This is a frequent and pretty common challenge here in North Carolina. so it means that there are a lot of families in the state with a lot at stake in this litigation. And this is not a new thing here in North Carolina. Going back to the 1990s, the Department of Social Services down here has, you know, not considered and not held it against families the sexual orientation of the partners seeking to adopt or seeking to become foster parents. This is something where there had sort of been, and that was what was so disappointing about the North Carolina Supreme Court ruling, is, you know, DSS on the one hand seems to be saying we're going to look at each family and say, is this in the best interest of the child based on each individual family? And then the North Carolina Supreme Court interpreted our adoption statutes to really foreclose that possibility and foreclose, you know, the opportunity of a lot of families in the state to provide the support protection that they want to be able to provide to their children.
Well, Chris, we wish you the best of luck with this lawsuit. We'll be following it and hope to have you back on to celebrate a victory.
I really hope that that happens, too, and really can't tell you how much I appreciate y'all having me on.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for your good work. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Rights advocates, robotics technology experts, lawyers, journalists, and activists gathered to bring detailed up-to-date information about the widespread and rapidly expanding deployment of both lethal and surveillance drones, including drone use in the United States. We go now to hear excerpts of two presentations delivered at the Drone Conference in Washington, D.C., titled Drone Summit, Killing and Spying by Remote Control. We hear an excerpt from Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange and the peace group Code Pink. She's also the author of the new book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. It's a comprehensive look at the growing menace of drone warfare, with analysis of who is producing the drones, where they're being used, and who pilots the unmanned planes. Let's have a listen.
You know, it's part of my job as a journalist to listen to what people are saying and to kind of make visible that which is not visible. And when I speak to sort of human rights advocates here about drones, what I hear from them is talk about transparency and accountability. And that's sort of the mantra here. The U.S. government must become transparent and accountable about who it's attacking. In Pakistan, it must let the military instead of the CIA, who currently carry out the attacks, take charge. That's because the CIA is secret. The military, the logic goes, will be more transparent and accountable. But I think from the perspective of the people on whom the Hellfire missiles explode daily, it doesn't matter whether the bombs come courtesy of the CIA or the military. They want the killing to stop. They want to stop dying. They want to stop having to go to funerals. So from that perspective, this question of transparency and accountability is a pseudo-problem, an abstract problem. It has nothing to do with the concrete fact of their daily murder. And it's a question that I think mistakes the law for ethics, and it mistakes the law for morality, and it confuses a legal question with the question of justice. It is, I think, a question that has more to do with an American conscience that wants a salve than with solving the problem of bombs over Pakistan, Yemen, or Somalia, and it has very little to say to the problem of killing and dying in those places. Maybe this is a provocative thing to say, but I mean to provoke because I do think that this is an astounding ethical failure of the broader anti-war movement in the United States. It's very well for the lawyers to push for transparency and accountability, and I do understand the reasons for doing so. The hope is that transparency and accountability will significantly reduce drone strikes by revealing the kill lists and opening them to question and meaningful review. And that's well enough, but I don't think that one should mistake that strategy for ethics. Or expect that that will stop the killing. So that's my first point. The second point is, you know, when I talk about these stories, quite often, inevitably, I will get the question, but what about the militants? Aren't there militants there? And I think this is an interesting question because, you know, here I am talking about the daily lives of these people, and I'm talking about lives lost, legs amputated, eyes gone, relatives lost. And here is the questioner telling me, I don't give a damn about this. Tell me about the militants. Talk to me about the militants. Well, first of all, the militant. Who is a militant? And how does one become one? There are obviously some who join because they want to do battle with America, and that makes sense. The United States is, after all, in Afghanistan, and it is attacking these areas in Pakistan. At other times, however, people join because simply because it makes more sense, because there might be intertribal rivalry, and they decide that it's more expedient to be part of a particular group, and has nothing to do with the larger ideological battle or the larger fight against the United States. In that case, is that person a militant? It's really not clear. So the line between militant and civilian is a faulty line, and when we start talking about those issues, is that it muddies the larger nature of this war. And it muddies the questions that we should be asking, and it obscures the daily experiences of most of the people who actually live in Waziristan, who actually have to deal daily with the bombs falling on their heads. You know, and that's really the right place to begin. The U.S. claims that it is hunting terrorists, but on what grounds does it make sense to terrorize people in order to hunt for terrorists? 7 to 8 drones buzzing daily, constant, 24/7, endless. Is it really okay to demand that these people, some of whom I've just shown you, live under conditions of terror so that Americans can feel safe? And actually, I do think that Americans are less safe because of it. You know, on what grounds does terrorism to end terrorism make sense? And if we start asking those questions, the answer to those questions is a journey through an entire history of racism and colonialism. This is, after all, not the first time that aerial flight and bombardment has been used to subject brown populations, non-white populations. You know, aerial flight was very much part of the civilizational idea of trying to express civilizational superiority. The British bombed Kabul in 1919, and Waziristan was also bombed in 1924. Back then, they were called policeman airplanes, and today they're called drones. But our real task now is to consider these human beings and to take their lives seriously. So I'll just stop there. Thank you.
We go now to hear from Trevor Tim, activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who specializes in free speech issues and government transparency. Let's have a listen.
Hi, my name's Trevor Tim. I'm from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I'd like to talk a little bit about secrecy in domestic drones. I know we've been hearing a lot about secrecy in the foreign context with the CIA drone program being completely classified and that kind of stifling debate in this country. And so the CIA is allowed to do essentially whatever it wants. But we've seen the same problem with domestic drones. As a couple of the panelists mentioned, the FAA has already authorized about 300 drones to fly around the U.S. But we don't, up until last week actually, we didn't know anything about these drones. We didn't know who was operating them. We didn't know what kind of drones. We didn't know what for. So the EFF filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit close to a year ago, and the asking for this information because they were keeping it completely secret despite the fact that if it's a manned vehicle, that this information is completely transparent. And so they basically ignored our request, and so we filed a lawsuit. And it's taken a couple months, but finally last week the FAA released a list of all of the organizations and agencies who have authorized drone use in this country. And, you know, it's the usual suspects, DHS, obviously, as the previous speaker mentioned, DARPA, the FBI, Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture, and a host of local law enforcement agencies. And so they released this list, but still they won't tell us what these drones are being used for. They won't tell us what kind of drones they are. And so our lawsuit still hasn't settled, and hopefully we're going to be getting more information soon. And that gets to the larger point of how we solve this problem. Because as also the other speaker mentioned, the Congress passed the FAA Modernization and Reform Act a couple months ago, which would dramatically expand the FAA's ability to give out drone certificates and authorized them to fly. Before this law passed, there was barely a peep in the media or anywhere else about what this law could do. The law actually wasn't focused on drones. It was an appropriations bill, and it gave a bunch of money to airports to improve, improve in construction and a bunch of other things. And then this drone provision was buried in the middle. And it wasn't until after the bill passed that it started getting reported on in the media, after the FAA said that there may be as many as 30,000 drones in the sky by 2020. And there is a reason that nobody knew about it. It's because they didn't really want us to know about it. Even the Privacy Caucus in Congress knew nothing about this until it passed. There was virtually no lobbying by privacy groups or anybody to stop this from happening. But the only people who did know about it was the drone lobby. And this is it's pretty amazing considering how little drones are flying so far, but the drone lobby is very big. They spent millions and millions of dollars just in the first quarter of this year to get this bill passed. And the website Republic Report obtained a PowerPoint presentation from the biggest drone trade group. And in the PowerPoint presentation, they brag about how nobody changed anything in the FAA bill except through their suggestions. And the drone clause in the bill was taken word for word, quote unquote, from what they suggested. And in addition, in this PowerPoint presentation, they talk about obstacles in getting more drone use in this country. And one of the top reasons on their list was, quote, civil liberties. So they take civil liberties as a business obstacle, not something that they have to work with or anything. They're trying to route around civil liberties. And as far as the FAA bill goes, it kind of worked because no one was paying attention. Thankfully, now that the bill has passed, there has been a lot more attention, especially given the FAA claimed that they may authorize as many as 30,000 drones in the next decade, a very scary number. So the question is, what can we do next? And as our other speakers alluded to, the FAA isn't actually, or at least historically, set up to address privacy regulations or violations. They have a very strong mandate to deal with safety. And they're actually taking comments about drone use right now. They've received about 50 or 60 comments about safety, a lot from pilots actually, saying how these drones will be unsafe to fly because they'll be colliding with other planes that are manned, or that they may lose radio signals and become sort of zombie drones that are flying around and nobody can control them. And they've actually only received, up until a couple days ago at least, two comments about privacy concerns. So I would implore everybody, if they are concerned about this, to actually contact the FAA directly and tell them your concerns. But thankfully, the Privacy Caucus in Congress has actually started to pay attention. The co-chairs of the Privacy Caucus are Ed Markey and Joe Barton, and they recently sent a letter to the FAA asking them a bunch of questions, and some of the questions being, what privacy protections and public transparency requirements has the FAA built into the current licensing process? And we know there are none. We had to sue to find out anything about these drones. And it says, their next question is the public notified about when and where these drones are used, who operates them, what data is collected, et cetera, et cetera? Again, the answer is no, they don't have a plan. Hopefully they'll have one soon. And these questions go on from here, like what are they going to do for privacy? It's a real open question about what they're going to do because they haven't had this problem before. But like Amy mentioned, this has come up in other contexts and other departments where they have not traditionally dealt with privacy, but then have been forced to. But we have to force them. And I guess the final point I'll make is about Congress and how we can get them to act. Congress has been very reluctant to act on any privacy concerns. As I'm sure many of you know, they just passed a cybersecurity bill that basically destroys privacy online. And they've also been hesitant to pass any sort of legislation regarding privacy, whether it's for GPS or warrants for cell phone tracking. And the Obama administration has been arguing in court that they shouldn't need warrants for this. And it's likely that they'll use the same arguments when it comes up when they're using drones warrantlessly. It may be important to take this to the state level, because at the state level, your legislatures may be more active and may be more willing to at least put in some sort of protections that can allow that can give citizens the rights they have normally under the Fourth Amendment, in which there aren't any real rules for drones.
That was Trevor Tim from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Rambling around your city, rambling around your town, I never see a friend I know as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. My sweetheart and my parents I left in my old hometown. I'm out to do the best I can as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. Peach trees, they are loaded, and the limbs are bending down. I pick 'em all day for a dollar, boys, as I go rambling around, as I go rambling around.
Sometimes Woodrow Wilson Guthrie, Woody Guthrie, was born, fittingly enough, 100 years ago on Bastille Day, July 14, 1912, in Okemah, Oklahoma. Music festivals around the country will be marking this centennial. Many of us know Woody by his most famous song, This Land Is Your Land. But he recorded many, many other songs, essentially a writer and a cartoonist, biographer, extremely productive. His Dust Bowl songs, his songs about the Pacific Northwest, are all American classics and chronicled at the Smithsonian Museum. Today, we're joined by Eli Smith to talk about Woody Guthrie, his life, and his music. Eli is a folklorist, a banjo player, writer, and a researcher, and has recently come out on Smithsonian Folkways Records, the same record company that produced Woody Guthrie's records, with the album The Old Man Below. Eli has an internet radio show called Down Home Radio Show, and we're real glad to have him on the program. Eli, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hey, glad to be here. Glad to be back.
You know, a lot of people have been influenced by Woody Guthrie. Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Bob Dylan went out to see him towards the end. And I know you've been very influenced by Woody Guthrie yourself. Tell us a little bit about Woody.
Well, Woody Guthrie would have been 100 years old had he lived to 100 this year. He was born on July 14th, Bastille Day, in a little town called Okemah, Oklahoma. As I say, July 14th, 1912. He moved here to New York, to Brooklyn, in 1940, so there's a lot of events going around the city to mark his 100th birthday. Of course, Woody Guthrie is the author of the well-known song, This Land Is Your Land, maybe an early kind of power to the people song, often known as a kind of second national anthem, for at least for some people here in America, sung by school children and so on. But actually, Woody Guthrie was really a radical guy. He was a socialist, just a radical artist in his era, working with the young Pete Seeger and Leadbelly and numbers of other folk singers in the early New York City folk music scene in the 1940s.
Before he came to New York and really settled here, He came from Oklahoma, went out to Texas, went out to California, had some experience underneath his belt before he came to New York. I suppose that's what so entranced radicals in New York. Woody Guthrie was the real thing. Talk about some of his experience and what he brought to New York City.
Well, Woody Guthrie played up his authenticity card quite a lot as a hobo and a rambling man and an authentic country personality. He was much more than that. His father was a successful businessman in real estate and stuff out in Oklahoma in the boom times there in the early 20th century, in the 20s. But then Woody's family suffered some real tragic events which put Woody out on the road. So he had grown up in kind of a stable, middle-class kind of family in Oklahoma in a little town. But then his mother began to suffer from Huntington's disease, the disease that ultimately killed Woody Guthrie in 1967 at the age of 55. But it began to affect his mother. She was committed to an insane asylum, and his father suffered business setbacks, and his sister was killed in a fire. And all these things destroyed their family and set Woody Guthrie on the road at a young age, where he interacted with migrant workers and so on in the Great Depression era and the Dust Bowl conditions of environmental degradation in the Southwest in the 1930s, and that brought him to California.
On that trip, because he went from Oklahoma to California, Eli, and he traveled with migrant workers on that, I understand.
Well,
and he also wrote a song about migrant workers, so maybe it's a time to just at least mention that song and what that song is. And
Woody Guthrie did travel with migrant workers. Of course, there were hundreds of thousands or millions of migrant workers that were riding the rails and so on in the 1930s. It was the great era for that when working-class Americans hit the road to try to find work anywhere that they could. In California, Woody started his career also as a radio personality, playing on the radio music. He was already writing and painting. He was a multifaceted artist, which he wrote many songs about migrant workers. The Deportees song, the plane wreck at Los Gatos Canyon. Woody never recorded that song. It was set to music later. I don't really like the tune that it was set to, but looking at the words, you can kind of tell what tune Woody actually set it to. Woody Guthrie, I don't believe he ever wrote an original melody. He was just a writer of words and a very, very talented one. I believe Woody Guthrie wrote the Deportees song to the tune of Get Along Little Dogies, Whoopie Tie Yo, Get Along Little Dogies.
Right, it's called, I think, Deportee, parentheses says, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos. Right, and refers to, I guess, about migrants going somewhere, home, and a plane
wreck. Well, I think
wreck.
They were deporting Mexicans back to Mexico, and there was an airplane which crashed and killed them. So he wrote a song commemorating that.
Eli, I understand that Woody also wrote political articles, books, even autobiographical sketches for radical newspapers. And
that's right,
he was a hater of injustice, but remained optimistic.
Yeah, definitely. Woody Guthrie started out writing a column for the Communist Party newspaper in California called the People's Daily World, I think it was called. And he continued that column in New York with the
Daily Worker.
The Daily Worker, thank you. And his column was called Woody Says, which was basically the same thing as Will Rogers' column, which I think was called Will Rogers Says. Woody loved Will Rogers, another Oklahoman. He was a Native American and an early sort of stand-up comic, and he was the host of Ziegfeld's Follies in New York, very, very famous political commentator. In any case, Woody really admired Will Rogers and kind of modeled himself on Will Rogers and also on Walt Whitman in terms of his writing and his poetry. So Woody Guthrie was a public intellectual, not just a folk singer. Not only was he a writer and performer of songs, but he also wrote poetry and he wrote prose and he wrote newspaper sort of opinion pieces. And he was also a talented painter and visual artist. He was really a Renaissance man, and much of that work has been published in the years since his death. His landmark autobiographical novel, Bound for Glory, was published in 1943. Definitely a part of the proletarian novel sort of format. but was also prefigured people like Jack Kerouac in a lot of ways in terms of being on the road and, you know, experiencing life from the bottom up as kind of an outsider. It was very, very interesting and very innovative. Would hope that people would also recognize him in that fashion as well.
I read that he also wrote children's songs.
Woody Guthrie had 8 children over the course of his life, and he loved kids. He was kind of a big kid himself in some ways, and he did several albums of children's songs for the Folkways record label, now the Smithsonian Folkways record label. And yeah, they're just wonderful songs, and those albums continue to be some of his most popular work.
I also understand he wrote Yiddish songs.
He wrote, his second wife, Marjorie Matzier Greenblatt, was Jewish, and they lived together in Coney Island in a Jewish section of town. Woody started to write some sort of Jewish-themed songs. He wrote some Hanukkah songs, and it's funny because they're very droll and southwestern, but celebrating Hanukkah and stuff like that.
I'm anxious to listen to them, but I have a question. Arlo was one of the products of that marriage, I think.
Sure.
We've talked about This Land Is Your Land, and actually a couple of questions about that. I go to one baseball game a year. I went yesterday or last week to the Yankees-Cleveland game, and of course there was a catch that the guy didn't really catch the ball, and then the Indians, who are my home team from Cleveland, which is not politically correct, but that's who they're called, but the Cleveland baseball team lost the game 6-4. At the end of like the seventh inning, they stood up and they played God Bless America, a Kate Smith recording, your dad tells me. And I said to my neighbors at the time, knowing that I was going to interview you the next day, saying, I think Woody Guthrie wrote This Land Is Your Land as a counter to God Bless America. What do you know about that?
Well, as far as I know, yeah, Woody Guthrie was kind of traveling around and hoboing around, and he kept hearing that song on jukeboxes. He really hated sort of this insipid pop music that's been droning on the airwaves for like, you know, almost 100 years now. So he composed This Land Is Your Land as kind of a response to that song. He set his words to a hymn that he probably grew up with or heard on a Carter Family record called When the World's on Fire. And that tune probably came into his head, and he wrote out the words. And he wrote that song a number of years before it was first recorded, but since that time it's really become sanitized because they kind of took out the more communistic verses. But it has become very well known, and as I say, is kind of a second national anthem along with America the Beautiful.
When he says this land is your land, do you have any sense of who he's referring to as the your? Is it just white Europeans who came? Is it everybody who's here? Who is it?
Through his song, he's trying to tell you that this land is your land, whoever you might be, and in his mind that would be the working class of whatever stripe or skin color.
There are a couple of verses to that song that are so wonderful. Obama was inaugurated. Pete Seeger was down in Washington at rally, and he sang the two verses that had been previously really censored. And I wonder if you could do those verses for the audience.
Well, you asked me to sing a bit of This Land Is Your Land with the often excluded verses that Woody wrote.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Was a great high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. And then there's another verse, maybe this is the one you're thinking of, that says, in the squares of the city, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And as they stood there hungry, I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Excellent. That was really moving.
Those verses are subversive. Eli, is there another song or two of Woody's that are particularly favorites of yours that you'd like to share with us?
We'd love to hear it.
Well, I have another Woody Guthrie song that I'd like to play for you on your show. And it's a lesser known one. Of course, This Land Is Your Land is his best known song. But here's one called I've Got to Know, which Woody did record and which was also recorded in a nice version by Utah Phillips. I've Got to Know by Woody Guthrie, set to the tune of the hymn Farther Along.
I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. Why do your war boats ride on my waters? Why do your death bombs fall from my sky? Why do you burn my farm and my town down? I've got to know, friend, I've got to know. What makes your boats haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why don't your ship bring food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've sure got to know. Why can't my two hands get a good paid job? I can still plow, plant, I can still sow. Why did your law book chase me off my good land? I've got to know, friend, I've just got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. What good work did you do? I'd like to ask you to give you my money right out of my hands. I built your big house to hide from my people. Why do you hide so? I've got to know. You keep me in jail, you lock me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. What made your cop kill my trade union worker? You'll have to talk plain, 'cause I've got to know. Why can't I get work and cash a big paycheck? Why can't I buy things in your place and your store? Why do you close my plant down and starve my buddies? I'm asking you, I've got to know. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
Great, Eli.
That's a beautiful
Thank
song.
You.
I had never heard that song, but you know, you could have written that song yesterday.
It's a lesser known one. Yeah, it seems quite contemporary.
Woody Guthrie died in 1967. You were born in 1982.
That's right.
You're 30, and he would have been 100. But he reached out over these decades, and I know you were very interested in him since you were a teenager. Talk to us about how he's influenced you and what you're doing with respect to his music.
Woody Guthrie's been very influential to a lot of people. For me, I always loved his songs, and being a leftist politically, I enjoyed that aspect of Woody Guthrie, but I always also enjoyed him as a folk musician from the Southwest, and a good old-time musician. He played the guitar as well as the mandolin, the fiddle, and the harmonica. And he was a wonderful musician. I loved his sound from the first moment that I heard it. So that's what I really liked about Woody Guthrie, in addition to his politics. A lot of people just take his music as, kind of a liberal or left political song. But I really concentrate on his style, and I'm an old-time string band musician. I record for the Smithsonian Folkways record label, as Woody Guthrie did, and that's been an honor. I'm hosting and curating a Woody Guthrie at 100 tribute concert at the Jalopy Theater on July 14th, Woody Guthrie's actual 100th birthday. That's on Saturday, July 14th, and at the Jalopy Theater, 315 Columbia Street in the Carroll Gardens, Red Hook area of Brooklyn. Jalopy.biz is the website. Or you can check out my internet radio show, Down Home Radio, downhomeradioshow.com, where I'll be posting information about the Woody Guthrie tribute at the Jalopy Theater. We're going to have a number of performers performing his songs, including myself, as well as John Cohen from the New Lost City Ramblers. I'll be reading from Woody Guthrie's works of poetry and prose. Jamie Longy will be there to read from his father's memoir. Jamie's father served with Woody Guthrie in the Merchant Marines in World War II. The Dust Bowl and World War II were the primary events in Woody Guthrie's life. So Jamie will be reading a little bit about that as well. We'll also be screening a short film, which is the only footage of Woody Guthrie in his prime. It's a film called To Hear Your Banjo Play that was made by Alan Lomax in the 1940s and is narrated by a young Pete Seeger. And it's just a wonderful film and features some wonderful performance footage of Woody Guthrie. So if you want to hear a whole bunch of his music performed by some great contemporary performers, as well as all that other stuff, come down to the Jalopy on July 14th and help us celebrate Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday.
And Eli, if we want to hear some of your music, how do we get that?
If you'd like to hear my band's new album on the Smithsonian Folkways record label, you can go to our website, dustbustersmusic.com, for more information on that. The album will be out in mid-August.
Eli Smith, it's been great. I've listened to your music since you've been a little kid. I went to the Brooklyn Folk Festival, heard you there, and hearing you play Woody Guthrie here was just wonderful. And, of course, your history and knowledge of Woody Guthrie is extraordinary. So thank you very much, Eli Smith.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you, Eli.
Well, thanks a lot. And, of course, Michael Smith here is my dad, and it's just like the Alan Sherman thing, my son, the folk singer. So here we are, and thanks for having me on the show.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at old Ludlow. I was worried bad about my children, soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you'd kill our children, dug us a cave that's 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and a pregnant woman down inside the cave to sleep. That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but a firewall stopped me. 13 children died from your guns. I carried my blanket to a wire fence corner, watched the fire till the blaze died down. I helped some people drag their belongings while your bullets killed us all around. I never will forget the look on the faces of the men and women that awful day when we stood around to preach their funeral and to lay the corpse of the dead away. We told the Colorado governor to phone the president, tell him call off his National Guard. But the National Guard belonged to the governor, so he didn't try so very hard. Our women from Trinidad, they hauled some potatoes up to Wallensburg in a little cart. They sold their potatoes and brought some guns back, and they put a gun in every hand. The state soldiers jumped us in the wire fence corners, did not know that we had these guns. And the redneck miners mowed down them troopers. You should have seen them poor boys run. We took some cement and walled the cave up where you killed these 13 children inside. I said, God bless the Mine Workers Union. Then I hung my head and cried.